Here in New Hampshire, we know resources are precious. Unspoiled wilderness, clean air, pure water. To be a Granite Stater is to know we must protect these for future generations. However, it's easy to forget that community resources like public radio need your protection too. Reporters with integrity, stories that bridge our divisions, about issues that matter. These are all things you've come to expect from NHPR. Help protect this precious resource for future generations by adding just one sentence to your estate plans. Learn more at nhpr.plannedgiving.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Election Day is just weeks away. Do you know where your ballot is? We'll check in on the voting process and a few key races. Also, the number of known cases of COVID-19 in New Hampshire is on the rise. How's the state responding? And what are your plans for Halloween this year? We're going down ballot later today as well on the roundup, but let's start with voting with NHPR's Casey McDermott. Hey, Casey.
Good morning, Peter.
Casey's been a valuable resource for listeners during this election season, following every twist and turn in the voting process. And if you've got questions now, now's a great time to call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Casey, how are local election offices handling all of this added work right now with so many ballots to sift through? What are you hearing from them?
Well, what I'm hearing from them is that they are very, very busy. I spoke with actually the town clerk in Merrimack recently, and she said that they actually went so far as to time out how long it takes for their office to issue just one ballot to a voter. And they actually found out that it's an average of 13 minutes for each ballot. So she said that's like all the prep, all the paperwork, you know, checking someone's ID, getting the ballot, everything kind of start to finish. And so that can add up pretty quickly. And especially in Merrimack, where they are, you know, expecting thousands of absentee voters this fall. And so for that community, that's meant actually that they've hired a number of staffers to kind of, you know, help deal with the workload. That's something that I'm hearing in other communities as well, especially like larger ones where they're also dealing with a higher volume of absentee ballots than normal. Other places have also kind of gotten creative in terms of either, you know, setting up a special window for absentee ballot or just voting transactions in the clerk's offices. Some places have set up what they're calling kind of voting centers. So I believe Portsmouth is one of the places that's done this, where they have kind of a dedicated space where someone can go and, you know, as they could at their clerk's office, take care of voter registration, absentee ballot requests, absentee ballot delivery, things like that, but just to kind of streamline the process a little bit more.
Okay. And are these towns, cities and towns, getting any help from the state or federal government to deal with this extra work?
Yeah, so basically, people may recall that a few months ago, the state did get an influx of money from some of that kind of federal relief COVID funding that came down. And what the state is doing is they are inviting communities to apply for funding to offset the costs of, you know, dealing with the kind of added responsibilities that they've taken on due to the pandemic and due to absentee voting. I don't believe that money has actually been like pushed out to communities yet. I think they're still in the process of, you know, evaluating the funding requests and looking at all of that. The state's brought in an accounting firm to help them evaluate that process. But long story short is that communities are banking on having some financial relief to help them weather all of the added kind of costs that they've taken on.
Okay, and are they optimistic they'll get that financial relief when they need it?
I think, I'm not entirely sure how soon that's going to come, but that's something that we're going to continue to keep an eye on.
Okay, and if people, the average listener listening, wants to help out with the election, are they able to? Can they still sign up?
In many cases, yes. But one thing that I have heard is, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm actually getting targeted, as I'm sure many other New Hampshire voters are, on social media or things like that with ads from national groups trying to encourage people to work the polls or sign up to help out with the elections. There's like a big push at a national level to get all people involved in the process. But one of the things that I've heard is that in some cases, it's kind of like no good deed goes unpunished, where people may, you know, sign up through one of those kind of outside websites or things like that. But when you're doing that, that's actually a little bit more complicated for your local election office, because they're not necessarily in touch with those outside national groups. So in order to like really get involved and to really do it in a way that's most helpful for your local election office, your best bet is to reach out to your local clerk's office. Or if, for example, you may know someone who's like your local moderator or something like that, reach out to the people in your community to ask what they need help with, rather than going through kind of a third party. And that should be easiest for everyone.
Follow-up question on volunteering as a poll worker, if I could, Casey. Is there a screening process for people who are stepping up to help out? And would being a member of one of the major parties in New Hampshire disqualify you? In other words, are they looking for nonpartisan poll watchers, or does that not matter?
That doesn't matter. No. So there are certain positions where the parties can appoint, you know, poll workers in certain capacities, but there isn't a, you know, there's not a kind of, you know, set of requirements that people need to meet, other than being, you know, in many cases, you have to be an eligible voter in the community that you're trying to work in for many of the positions. There are also a number of positions. Again, this varies just because there's so many different roles at the polls on election day, but there are some positions where, for example, like a 17-year-old, a high schooler or something like that, could work as like a greeter at the polls, and could help to offset some of the labor in that way. So it really varies, and that's why it's really important for people to reach out to their local elections office and see where they need help.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about absentee voting. Do you have a sense of how many Granite Staters are voting absentee right now?
We do. So actually, the Secretary of State's office has been updating these numbers weekly at this point. So as of Tuesday morning, this is a few days out of date now, but it's the latest data that we have, more than 78,000 general election absentee ballots had already been returned by voters. So that's a lot, but just to put it into perspective, that's actually more absentee ballots than were counted in total during the 2016 general election. So that's putting us on pace to have like pretty significant absentee turnout, certainly. And, you know, election officials are also still preparing for a fair amount of in-person voters as well. So even though there's all of this work and all of this effort in place to allow people to vote absentee, you know, for health and safety reasons, there's also still a lot of preparations that are being put into place to ensure that people can still participate safely should they show up to vote on election day.
Listeners, if you've got questions about the voting process, now's a great time to get an answer. Give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Casey McDermott, the AG's office, recently issued some voter alerts. What were those about?
So they've actually put out three in the last week or so, and they're about different kinds of messages that have gone out to voters in some cases, you know, across the state, and in other cases in kind of a smaller region. And basically, the New Hampshire Attorney General's office is issuing these voter alerts because they believe that these messages are either misleading or at the very least confusing. In some cases, the AG's office said that the, you know, the messages may have, you know, violated the law in terms of disclosing where they came from or just giving accurate information about the voting process. And the messages that they've called out have come from, in one case, a local Democratic committee in the Upper Valley. They sent out a batch of sample ballots, which is not unusual for political parties to kind of send out, you know, here's the candidates that we support. The problem is that the word sample was dropped from those ballots before they hit voters' mailboxes. So that's obviously something that could be confusing. The party committee said that it was, you know, it's a mistake. They're working to rectify it. And the AG's office is actually forcing them to come up with a plan to remedy the situation by the end of the day today. There was also some text messages that came from the SEIU. And then there was also this kind of mailing that hit a lot of people's mailboxes recently that came from an anonymous sender that was sending people absentee ballot requests. And they came with a note saying, you are needed, please fill this out and mail it in. And it just kind of caught a lot of people off guard. So what we actually did was we have on nhpr.org right now, a kind of guide for like making sense of all of these different voting solicitations you're receiving right now. And this comes from, again, guidance from the AG's office about what is and is not legit and legal. But also just comes from our own research into, you know, here's the kinds of things that you may be seeing and here's what to watch out for. And, you know, here's why maybe you don't need to panic if you received an absentee ballot request. That doesn't mean that someone's trying to, you know, trick you or duplicate your vote or anything like that. We just wanted to kind of give people some, you know, context to better kind of sort through the piles and piles of political mail that they're getting right now.
Mm-hmm. Casey, we get this emailed question from Arnie, who asks, are law enforcement agencies preparing for the presence of armed militia groups at the polls?
I'm not aware of anything coordinated, but that is a very good question. I do know that I've been sitting in on these webinars that the Secretary of State and Attorney General's office has been doing with local poll workers to kind of prepare them for the elections. And there have been a number of questions recently about how to deal with observers or people who are showing up to watch the polls in a number of capacities. So it's something that election officials are talking about. One of the things that the state has encouraged local election officials to do is to reach out to their local law enforcement agencies or their local police stations to see, you know, just to kind of be in touch. Many poll workers are already in communication with the local police department around an election, even pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, pre-2020, just to kind of make sure that they're ready should anything urgent come up the day of the election. But I'm not aware of anything specific in terms of a kind of strategy for dealing with the, what the emailer mentioned. But I can tell you that it's definitely, you know, the idea of kind of ensuring calm and ensuring that everyone can, you know, vote without intimidation or, those kinds of things is definitely something that poll workers and election officials are talking about a lot.
And Casey, just a couple questions really quickly before we have to let you go. One is a question about how to, because we've talked about what kind of writing utensil to use on this program before. We've talked about Sharpies. Is there a kind of writing utensil that works best for your absentee ballot or any ballot?
Yeah, it kind of depends on who you talk to. So the Secretary of State's office says that they do not, you know, specify a particular writing utensil for absentee ballots, that anything should work fine. What I've heard, though, from some local election officials is that there are certain kinds of writing utensils that work best. One official, the Hanover town clerk, Betsy McLean, said that she kind of puts it into perspective for people by saying, you know, what would you use to write a letter or like a grocery list? You probably wouldn't use a Sharpie for that. And that generally speaking, if you live in a town that uses one of the AccuVote ballot counting machines, the scanner recognizes black ink best, according to Betsy in Hanover. And I've heard from other local officials that, they generally recommend black or blue ink, and that's a recommendation that they've received from the company that manufactures the ballot counting devices. However, there are mechanisms within the devices to kind of flag, you know, ballots that may appear like that, you know, the machine may have not caught the marking on. So there's processes in place to try to ensure that, you know, even if you may have used a writing utensil that for whatever reason wasn't picked up by the machine, that gets caught and that your vote still gets counted.
So the takeaway there is, you know, follow the directions, but also don't panic if something gets wrong, because there's still time to remedy it. Is that what I'm hearing?
So there's processes that would ideally catch, you know, issues with the writing utensil that that someone may have used as like during the counting process. And then the other thing too that's come up, like you mentioned the Sharpies, there's been some like concern about like, can you use Sharpies? Can you not use Sharpies? And the problem there is that people have been, you know, worried that the markers bleed through their ballots. What I've been told by both local and state election officials is that generally speaking, if you use a Sharpie or if you use like any, you know, marker that bleeds through, that should not spoil your ballot, because if you look at the way the ballot's laid out, the bubbles do not line up on, you know, if it's two-sided. And the way that the machines read, they read kind of down in a line. So if you used a Sharpie and it bled through, you shouldn't need to worry about, you know, your ballot being kind of, you know, messed up or needing a new one. That's the word that I've received from state and local election officials who've gotten questions about it.
Okay. And really quickly, Casey, what will you be examining in the coming weeks leading up to the election?
So there's obviously still a lot of kind of, you know, final preparations that local election officials are going through. This is also really when like a lot of voters, you know, really engage with the process. So my colleagues and I are looking at, you know, a number of different angles in terms of, you know, how residents are exercising their right to vote, you know, who's running into challenges, if at all. And we're also, you know, we are always open to hearing about, you know, positive experiences too. We want to make sure that we're focusing on any issues that warrant attention, but we also want to make sure that we are making it clear to people that like there are solutions and there are ways to ensure that your vote is counted.
Well, NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
And worth mentioning that on Monday on The Exchange, we're going to do a whole show on voting issues, and we'll get your questions answered on absentee voting versus mail-in voting. We can talk all about the security measures that are in place to ensure that your vote is counted as it's supposed to be. Again, that's Monday on The Exchange beginning at 9. And if you have questions about the voting process, we'll get them answered then as well. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Tune in Monday at 9. And let's turn now to NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers for a look at some of the races we're thinking about as we get ready to vote. Hey, Josh.
Good morning, Peter.
So NHPR recently held 3 live debates for each of the 2 congressional districts and the Senate race between Democrat Jeanne Shaheen and Republican challenger Corky Messner. What did we learn from watching the candidates react to each other in real time, Josh?
Well, you know, Peter, these obviously were socially distant debates, so it was a bit different than normal. But it was interesting to see the candidates face off. In District 1, it really came across how aggressively Republican challenger Matt Maurer is going after incumbent Democrat Chris Sununu. You know, Maurer may need to do that, though, you know, sometimes it was in a facts-be-damned manner, you know, particularly in suggesting that Pappas has pushed for a state income tax, not true during Pappas' time in the state legislature. You know, in the Senate debate, meanwhile, I was really struck by the relatively muted tone of Corky Messner yesterday out on the campaign trail. There's a lot more of an edge in the way he speaks of Senator Shaheen, D.C., Jeanne Shaheen. He derides her, as there was less of that in this debate. And it was interesting to hear him talk issues, you know, on the environment, striking a somewhat different tone than some Republicans. You know, there were definitely differences to be seen. And in the second congressional district, the debate between Steve Negron and Ann Custer, you know, they faced each other last time. This is a bit of a rematch. And, you know, hearing them discuss their different views on COVID spending and also Negron's take as a Latino on, you know, racial issues in the country was interesting to hear. You know, he, at least in theory, faces more of an uphill climb than the other Republicans due to the nature of the second district. You know, polling indicates, you know, this is a tough situation for all challengers, the Republicans in the federal races. And, Democrat Dan Feltes in the governor's race.
Yeah. Josh, do you see any of these races tightening at all as a result of what we've heard in the past week on these debates and elsewhere?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, typically people tend to sort of drift towards their party orientation. I mean, the polling indicates that, the incumbents hold edges, most significant Governor Sununu and Senator Shaheen. We'll see. I mean, one thing we don't know is a lot of votes have already been cast. New Hampshire may have a higher percentage of people who plan to vote in person than some other states, but, a good number of people have already made up their minds. And so, for debates to make a difference, people have to be watching and listening to them, and the press needs to be reporting on them. And so, we'll see come Tuesday when Democratic challenger Dan Feltes faces Governor Sununu. He's clearly got ground to make up. He likely sees this debate as an opportunity to go after Sununu. There are clear differences on policies. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens there. But, in an age of social media, the notion that debates really necessarily form a voter's opinion is more of an open question than it has been in the past.
Yeah. What about fundraising, Josh? I believe you reported a little bit on some gubernatorial fundraising numbers this week. Who has the advantage?
Well, in terms of money on hand, Governor Sununu has, I think, a 5-to-1 advantage over Dan Feltes. Feltes did outraise Governor Sununu in the last month. There's going to be outside spending, and there has been outside spending. The Republican Governors Association has spended to boost Governor Sununu. The state Democratic Party spent, upwards of $1 million to try to tie Governor Sununu to President Trump. I see that as kind of a twofer. It's going after Trump. It's also linking Sununu, who is, by far the most popular Republican in New Hampshire, and, who really may, what happens to him in this election really, the extent to which he has coattails could have big, or lack thereof, could have a big effect on, the future complexion of the state house. So we'll see. I mean, Governor Sununu has a big edge in cash in the final couple weeks here.
Okay. And in these last few weeks, what will you be following with respect to the presidential race here?
Well, I'll be following just as much as possible, across the gamut, really. This is an interesting time. I mean, as I mentioned, a lot of people have voted already, and, following voters in a socially distant manner is certainly new to me. I like to talk to people in person, so I'm going to be trying to do a lot of that. Voters are really, they're the people who decide these things at the risk of being obvious. So I want to talk to them as much as possible. You can certainly get a sense of what they're feeling off of social media, but, they're going to have to go in and cast a ballot if they haven't already. And, just be interesting to see the degree to which I'm going to be looking at Governor Sununu as really the standard bearer of the party here. He's certainly the candidate more than President Trump in the closing days, around which many of these other candidates have rallied around. You hear, Governor Sununu coming up more in these debates as somebody that the Republicans point to more than President Trump, which, may be a measure of how those candidates are being strategic in the closing moments. But, oftentimes the top of the ticket really does carry on down. And so, what happens between President Trump and Joe Biden is going to have a big effect, too.
NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers, thanks very much. And stay safe as you go try to talk to people in person about these candidates.
I will do my best, Peter.
All right. Thank you very much. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And don't forget, too, to tune into that gubernatorial debate Tuesday, October 20th at 9 a.m. That's coming up. And you can hear all of the previous debates at our website, nhpr.org. Still to come, the number of COVID-19 cases is rising. We're going to take a look at why and how has this rise affected you. Give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. The state announced 82 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 yesterday, as well as 5 additional deaths. There's also a higher number of known cases this week, 829. That's compared to 531 last week. For more on the rise of COVID recently, we turn to Ashley Conley, Director of Infection Prevention at Catholic Medical Center. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So what does the data currently show in terms of COVID-19 positive test rates in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so something we've been seeing even here at the hospital is we had in the summertime where it was low numbers, you know, we weren't really seeing a lot of hospitalizations, which is great. And then now over the last couple of weeks, we have started to see a little bit of that increase and that little creep upward in the number of cases that we're seeing and in the number of hospitalizations.
And has that put any strain on the hospitals as far as you know?
No, it hasn't, thankfully. You know, the numbers are still pretty small. But it just is that, you know, that pulse check we do every day when we look to see how many people are admitted, how many tests that we've seen come back positive in the community. We are just starting to see that little bit of incline.
Mm-hmm. And why? Why are the numbers increasing?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you had asked many of us a couple months ago what our thoughts were, we probably all said, well, we're not going to be too surprised if come October, November, we're going to start to see an increase. And a lot of that has to do with just our behaviors, you know, how we're outside a lot in the summer, you know, there's a lot of activities we can do. But then as the weather starts to get colder, a lot of us start to be inside more, we're in close quarters. And then I also think we're starting to have a little bit of that COVID fatigue, too, where we're really getting tired of wearing masks, social distancing, and all of that. So that definitely plays a part, too.
People are getting frustrated and saying, I just don't feel like wearing the mask right now. I've been wearing it for months and months, and I'm over it.
That's right. And I get it. I've been wearing it for months and months, too. So I understand. It's not always fun to have to wear it.
Okay, so part of it's on us to not give in to the COVID fatigue. Are we seeing more community transmission from schools? Do you know?
I think we probably are seeing some of that community transmission. I know that sports has definitely been something where we're starting to see some sports teams where a number of children on that team will come down with it or have a multi-state involvement. So I do think just in general when we have situations like that, you're going to have viruses like to spread their job in life, right? That's what they like to do. And so sometimes those prime settings are an opportunity for that to happen.
Yeah, okay. So does this appear to be the start of a second surge, in your opinion?
Yes, you know, that's a good question. And I think we'll just have to wait and see how it goes. This could just be, you know, a temporary little surge that we're seeing. It could mean that, you know, we're going to see the same level over many, many weeks. It could go away in a couple weeks, and then we could see it come back around the holidays. So I don't know exactly how, but I don't think it's going to be going away. I can say that, you know, over the next, you know, couple weeks to months.
Yeah. So is there one particular number that you keep your eye on? I mean, I mentioned at the start of the segment, number of new known cases this week, 829 compared to 531 next week. Is that the number that you watch really carefully, the known cases?
So we pay particular attention to that percent positive. So that percent positive number, meaning out of how many tests we do, how many are positive. So that's one thing we look at. And if that starts to creep up, we keep a close focus. And then the other one we look at is just hospitalizations. You know, out of everybody getting sick, how sick are they getting? And that's just important for us to know about resources in all the hospitals in New Hampshire. So we keep an eye on that. And thankfully, right now, with, you know, the younger population getting sick, we're not seeing a lot of them getting hospitalized or needing that extensive care, thankfully.
I see. And so with respect to the testing numbers, is the state testing enough, or should the state be doing more?
So, you know, I think in some ways, a lot of us are probably getting tired, too, about, you know, oh, I have to go get tested if I start to come down with those mild symptoms. So some of us might be having that fatigue, too, of I don't want to get tested. But with COVID, you could have some minor symptoms. And, you know, if you have somebody that lives with you that's really compromised or, you know, you're in community settings a lot, it's so important for them to get tested. But I think just personally, people are probably like, I'm not doing that. But then for those that are getting tested, I think we are doing a good job at least trying to capture those that are sick and testing everybody that we know is sick. That I think we've been doing a good job on, but we could always have improvements there, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk later this hour about what Halloween's going to look like this year. So as someone who studies infection, what's your opinion? Does having Halloween outside and handing out candy to strangers seem like the right thing to do right now? Is that going to be safe?
Yeah, and you know, and I'm a mom too, so I've been thinking about what are we going to do for Halloween, you know, and I haven't figured it out exactly yet. Being outside is helpful, right? And also with trick-or-treating, you can keep distance. You know, you don't have to get really close to somebody when you're trick-or-treating. But I think there's some really important things if they are going trick-or-treating to keep in mind. So wearing masks will still be important. Taking some hand sanitizer with you to make sure that you're doing that frequently while you're out trick-or-treating. And then, you know, if you want to be extra cautious, you know, making sure that the candy, you know, is safe, obviously, to eat. But then also, you know, it wasn't somebody else's house. So just be mindful of, you know, should I just wipe it down first before, you know, we eat it? So just some consideration for those that are going to be out trick-or-treating later this month.
And if your town is providing some kind of alternative celebration to the traditional door-to-door candy hunting, I guess you could call it, is that preferable, or would it depend on whatever the alternative is?
Yeah, I know some of the towns that I've seen having events, they're limiting it, so you have to register in advance. So that's good because you can really keep down the total number that are there. So you probably won't see, you know, the couple hundreds going to the event like we have in past years. Hopefully next year we can do that. But limiting it in number is important, and then having some rules and guidelines there, making sure they're cleaning and disinfecting, making sure everything's spread out. They're creating opportunities for all the right things.
Okay, and so apart from Halloween celebrations, what can listeners do to keep themselves safe as the weather gets colder and we transition to a life lived mostly indoors?
Right. And this is kind of something we all have to just get used to day to day. And a couple of things is just being mindful of just the really crowded places. You know, if you don't have to be someplace that's really crowded, avoid that setting. The other one is really small, confined spaces where you have a lot of people. So it might be a small room, you know, with a number of people in there. And trying to battle that COVID fatigue where, you know, you still wear masks, still bring your hand sanitizer or washing your hands with soap and water to keep that up and going, especially getting closer to the holidays.
Mm-hmm. And how is our understanding of this virus changing or evolving as we go along? Have we learned anything significant and new recently?
I think some of the research that's coming out now is helping to confirm maybe some of the things that we saw, say, in healthcare in the community early on, where we were still just really learning. So it has been nice to see, okay, yes, here the CDC is putting out information related to how it's transmitted and how to protect yourself. And we know a lot more now about that than we did back in March. I remember when we went to universal masking here at the hospital on March 23rd, it was kind of like that was a newer thing, right? It wasn't mandatory or it wasn't required a lot of places. We weren't really doing it. But then here we are a couple months later, and one of our big prevention measures is wear a mask. So I do think we've seen some changes in what we've known and understand about this virus.
Mm-hmm. And what about traveling for the holidays coming up in November and December? There's going to be a lot of people looking ahead and saying, well, you know, if I get tested and I take 2 weeks of quarantine and then I can travel and then I can be indoors with my family and be safe. What's the latest guidance or advice that you've heard that you feel is sound and that you would follow yourself or your family?
Yeah, I think it's really important that people really think about, do I really want to bring, you know, 20 family members from across multiple states together into one house? And can I really be sure that all of my family members are going to quarantine the right way for 14 days beforehand? And just really kind of do a risk assessment. And, you know, is it something where I want to have my elderly family members there and put them at risk? So it's a personal decision. It's something that a family has to decide. But just think about, you know, can we really do this safely? And is it really worth the risk this year? Maybe there are certain circumstances where, yes, they do feel it is. But then, you know, overall, is it really something you want to do? Remember with testing, it's good for that day, right? But it doesn't mean that I couldn't be slightly incubating that virus where a day or two later I could be positive. So just keep that in mind. So that 2 weeks of quarantine would be the perfect setting for that, where you know for 2 weeks you're quarantining. There's no way I've come in contact with somebody with it, and then I can go and visit family.
But what a logistical challenge, right? Because you've got 2 weeks before whatever given holiday and then 2 weeks after whatever given holiday. It sort of really changes your whole life and the life of your family for a solid month.
It does. And that's why I looked to other options. You know, I know for Easter we did a little family Zoom meeting where we weren't together then. But then, you know, there might be certain situations where, yes, you know, I really do need to see my parents. But if you're going to do that, just think about how can we do it safely. Can we all wear masks? You know, can we still keep ourselves separated when we're in the house together? Think of all those things we've been talking about the last couple months during the holiday season.
Mm-hmm. So overall, how can we prevent the number of positive cases from increasing further in your mind?
I think sticking to all these hallmark, you know, prevention messages that we have is really going to help prevent that spread. But then at the end of the day, having, you know, good, solid treatments for this disease is going to be important. And then having a vaccine that we can give, especially to people that are really compromised and just need that vaccine to help them stay safe.
Well, Ashley Conley, Director of Infection Prevention at Catholic Medical Center, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Here are some of the stories that NHPR has been following this week. An additional $100 million in pandemic relief money from the Federal CARES Act is going to small and mid-sized businesses in the state. Governor Sununu announced yesterday that the state is launching a second round of the Main Street Relief Fund. The application period will run through October 30th. More than 5,000 companies received grants during the first round of the program. Also, the Poor People's Campaign, as well as the disability rights activists, protested outside of Governor Chris Sununu's press conference yesterday afternoon. They were there to demand more transparency and better care for those living with a disability during the pandemic. Activists say the state's current public health response is also harming other disadvantaged groups, including people of color. Organizers say they've mailed their demands to the governor's office, so far without a response. And the state's largest solar array is now complete atop a beer distributor in Manchester. The installation will provide just over a megawatt of power to Bellavance Beverage Company near Manchester-Boston Regional Airport. It's the largest solar array now operating in the state, and that's mainly because companies can't sell more than 1 megawatt of excess solar power back to the grid under current state law. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and still to come, we will be talking a little bit more about Halloween festivities, what they will look like across the state. We want to know how you are planning to celebrate. If you are, give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And we'll also turn our attention to the latest in our down ballot series, looking at some races down the ballot that don't often get a lot of attention. Today, Register of Probate and Register of Deeds. That's coming up. If you've got questions, email them now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for tuning in. Halloween is just about 2 weeks away, but like most things in 2020, it won't be what we are used to. The CDC is encouraging Americans to consider safer alternatives to showing up on strangers' doorsteps looking for candy. So, what's going to happen this spooky season? For insight, we turn to Nate Grays, an attorney with the New Hampshire Municipal Association. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Peter. Good morning.
So who's going to decide what Halloween will look like in New Hampshire this year? Is it up to the state, or does each town get to make its own decision?
Well, Halloween's traditionally been something that towns work with their communities on. So that's what I think we're going to see this year. We've seen some communities say, hey, we don't want to do Halloween this year, or we want to do it very differently from the way we've done it before.
Okay. And so what are most towns choosing to do? Will there be trick-or-treating?
I think most towns are probably doing trick-or-treating, but they're asking their communities to do it in a way that's a little bit safer this year, to have some social distancing, have everybody wear masks, do one-way trick-or-treating. Those are all popular options that are being talked about.
What about big parties, hayrides, gatherings in blocked-off streets? So what about those?
Those are being discouraged, and I know from my local community that some of the neighborhoods that often do blocked off streets have said, yeah, we're not going to do that this year. And I think everyone understands that, you know, there's this concern with large groups of people coming together.
Yeah. Yeah. And if families choose to go trick or treating, what special protocols can they use to keep themselves safe?
Well, as your last guest mentioned, masks, and not Halloween masks. We're talking about our
actual
COVID
masks
we've been wearing.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are key. And then also, kind of evaluate the situation. If you're handing out candy, socially distance. You know, there are all sorts of options with PVC tubes, throwing candy, etc. But if you're going to pick up candy, just, you know, be careful you're not going to end up in a crowded space with other people.
Got it. And so you recently led a webinar for the New Hampshire Municipal Association on what Halloween will look like this year. So what are the biggest questions you heard from participants? What are people most concerned about?
I think people are really concerned about how to minimize the risk. A lot of people are very interested in having Halloween, having some sort of celebration, because it is the end of fall. It's really the last big outdoor event that we can do in New Hampshire. And that was really what the focus on was, you know, we want to do trick-or-treating, but how do we do it in a way that minimizes risk of COVID?
Okay. Well, let's switch gears, Nate Graves, and talk a little bit about our Down Ballot series, our series on some of the races that don't often get a lot of attention. Today, we want to talk about Register of Probate and Register of Deeds. Let's talk first about the Register of Probate. What does this position do, and what role do they play in people's lives?
So the Register of Probate used to be a very important position, but in 2011, the legislature reorganized the court system, and now it's honorary. It's in the Constitution, so you know, unless there's a constitutional amendment, we can't get rid of the position. But at present, it really doesn't do a whole lot.
So who typically wants this position that doesn't do a whole lot?
Typically, people who work with wills or trusts and estates, those type of people are really interested in this because it has the potential to do more, but it just doesn't at the moment.
Wow. Okay. So is this position ever controversial? Does it ever make the news?
It's controversial in that some candidates run on the platform that we should have a constitutional amendment to get rid of the position, and some candidates run on the platform that we need to give this position more authority to work with the court system and to save any of the files that have historical significance, which is historically what it's done, things like wills and those type of forms.
Okay, and is this position a launching pad for something else, or is it, as you say, basically sought after by people who want to make it mean something or mean more?
It's really not a launching pad. Just looking at who is kind of running this year, it looks like a lot of people already involved in politics often run, but it's not really a launching pad for anything because it doesn't really have any responsibilities, so there's no kind of step up to go from here.
Okay, well, what about Register of Deeds? What does the Register of Deeds do, and does this person impact the lives of Granite Staters on a regular basis?
So the Register of Deeds is actually a very important position. The register actually oversees the registry, and the registry is basically the permanent record of all land ownership in the state. So if you own your house, any mortgages on that, if your neighbor has the right to use your driveway, any of that stuff, it's going to be at the registry. So making sure that all of that information is kept safe and that it's accessible to people buying real estate, selling real estate, any sort of legal actions, your local municipality for tax map purposes, all of that is very, very important, but it's not an office people think a lot about.
Wow. Okay. So what kind of skills does a good Register of Deeds need?
I think organization is probably the key skill, but also that passion for property law, because there are a lot of different things that the register does besides overseeing the office. Especially in today's day and age, there's a lot of digitalization going on of old records. There's a lot of looking at old records and seeing can we bring this up so it's more accessible to the public and to people who need access to it. So there are a lot of different initiatives that different registers are doing across the state.
Okay. And who typically runs to be a Register of Deeds?
I think it's people who are really passionate about property, but it's not something that's usually very competitive. So oftentimes it's somebody who's worked in the office for a long time. And then once the current register retires or moves on, usually some of their deputies run for the position.
So let's say there's a property boundary dispute between neighbors. Does the Register of Deeds somehow come in as arbiter of that, or is there a different role for the Register of Deeds in that case?
So the register actually has what I would consider the original copies of the deeds. So the judge at the courthouse would decide, where the property line is for sure if there's a dispute between the deeds, but the register actually has the copies of the deeds. So you could, in most cases, you can go back, look at the deeds, and they tell you where that boundary line is. But you may need the help of someone like a surveyor to clearly change that from the deed to, you know, actually being able to see it, because those are sometimes hard to read.
I see. Okay, so this person would be a keeper of the official documents that, you'd refer to if you had some kind of dispute like that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, and how long is the term for Register of Deeds?
It's 2 years.
2 years. Okay. Same thing for Register of Probate. I failed to ask about.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. It's most positions are 2 years in our state.
And is this position, Register of Deeds, ever controversial? Does it make the news? Is there something people should look for when choosing the register?
It's not very controversial. It's a pretty low-key race. There really isn't a lot that that happens that's controversial at the Register of Deeds usually.
That sounds like a good thing, especially
yes,
when it comes
absolutely.
To property rights. Yeah, okay. And anything in particular newsy about this one? Are most registers of deeds running unchallenged? I'm not sure if you've done quite a survey of that.
I think most are this year. I don't know of any challenge positions, but I think there might be a couple. You know, there hasn't been a whole lot in the news about them recently. There is an association, the New Hampshire Register of Deeds Association, which simply provides links to all the different county registries. That's a good place for voters to look at, just if they're interested in learning about what the register does and to find out more about what other counties are doing, as well as their own.
Well, Nate Graves, attorney with the New Hampshire Municipal Association, thank you so much for being on the program. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter.
And listeners, if you'd like to hear previous installments of our Down Ballot series, which includes an analysis of the races for sheriff, you can check out the Exchange podcast feed or check out the Exchange archive at nhpr.org. Let's turn now to an excerpt from one of the debates that we've had between the major party candidates coming up that occurred this week. We've got Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen and Republican challenger Corky Messner met to debate live on NHPR this week. The candidates touched on issues including the coronavirus pandemic, criminal justice reform, and the Supreme Court. Here, NHPR's Annie Ropeek asked Messner and Shaheen about their proposals for fighting climate change.
First, Mr. Messner, it's a scientific fact that human activity is causing the current rapid warming of our climate. And that same science says we have at best a few decades or less to lower greenhouse gas emissions in order to avoid millions of deaths, mass migration, and a double-digit percentage hit to the American economy. So my question for you is, what economic opportunities do you see in addressing this problem? 60 seconds, please.
Yes, climate change is real. We have one planet, and we all should take care of it and do everything we can to take care of it. That's why I've helped conserve and preserve 250 acres in New Hampshire. You know, there are plenty of economic opportunities. Look at what Tesla has done with the electric car market. And it has caused the major automotive manufacturers to more aggressively pursue manufacturing electric cars. There are opportunities in alternative fuels that can help the environment, wind power, solar power. And the market ought to be unleashed to solve those problems. And encouraging businesses to do that will help solve this climate change problem.
One follow-up question on clean car standards. You mentioned electric vehicles. Under President Trump, we've seen rollbacks of vehicle efficiency standards. We've seen lawsuits with the state of California about its efficiency standards. Do you think that those kinds of regulatory moves are a good idea? 30 seconds, please.
Yeah, I generally think there's too much government regulation. I think it's been a benefit to the United States, the United States national security, and the United States economy to become energy independent, and we have to continue to do that. I think the regulatory environment, ultimately does more harm than good, and I think that if we continue to provide incentives to these companies to manufacture electric cars, then it'll make the need for this kind of regulation not necessary.
And on the topic of incentives, you also mentioned wind and solar power. Some tax credits for those industries are currently expiring. Would you support additional incentives along those lines to help those industries compete with fossil fuels? 30 seconds, please.
Yeah, I think very targeted incentives are good. I think the government picking winners and losers is not good. We saw that under the Obama administration when they tried to do that. It turned out to be pretty wasteful. But I think incentives to businesses, then you still have the market working. I think it's a good thing. And I think the ingenuity and creativity of Americans will solve this problem.
Thanks so much, Mr. Messner. And to you, Senator Shaheen, Vice President Joe Biden has said he will not immediately ban all fracking in America. How do you square that with the sense of urgency that you have said is necessary to address the climate crisis? 60 seconds, please.
Well, some fracking is not bad, depending upon what's used in that fracking and how they deal with water. But the fact is, we need to address our climate crisis. It is an existential threat, and I'm pleased that my opponent is now finally acknowledging that. And I agree with him around conservation. When I was governor, I worked with Judd Gregg as senator to conserve 171,000 acres of land in northern New Hampshire. Now I'm sponsoring legislation with Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, for energy efficiency. We've gotten some pieces of it done, but that energy efficiency legislation, if we can get it passed, will not only save thousands of pounds of pollution, because 40% of our energy is in buildings, but it will also create about 300,000 jobs a year. So there are definitely good jobs that can be had if we switch to clean energy, just as we're seeing in New Hampshire with the focus on wind.
Senator Shaheen, you have been working on that proposal with Republican Senator Portman for a number of years. You have many other bipartisan bills with Republicans, many of which have not been able to pass. Do you think that the approach to bipartisan climate action has been effective? And would you change that at all, especially depending on how the balance of power shifts after this election? 30 seconds, please.
Well, for the first time in this last year of Congress, what we have seen in the Senate is a bipartisan caucus to begin to address climate change. That's the first time that's happened since I've been in the Senate, that our Republican colleagues have finally come to the table. I was one of the original members of that. There are eight of us, four Democrats and four Republicans. And we're looking at legislation that we can move on now, like our energy efficiency legislation with Rob Portman, that can see savings both in terms of pollution, but also in terms of job creation.
And then just on natural gas, the idea of fracking, natural gas is often held up as a bridge fuel. Many environmentalists worry about how to transition off of that if it is more supported in this sort of transition period. How do you see the federal government kind of allowing that transition to happen, not perpetuating natural gas use, if that is, in your view, a problem driving emissions? 30 seconds, please.
Well, New Hampshire's made use of natural gas as we phased out our dependence on oil, and I think that's been a good bridge fuel, and it will continue to be. One of the things that we've got to do is encourage alternative energy sources, energy efficiency, and there are ways to do that through incentives, through production tax credits, as you pointed out. Those are about to expire. We need to renew those. Through biofuels and biomass, which is really important to New Hampshire.
That was incumbent Senator Gene Shaheen and challenger Corky Messner debating on NHPR, and you can listen to the entire debate at our website, nhpr.org. And don't forget to tune in for the last debate in our series Tuesday of next week with incumbent Republican Governor Chris Sununu and Democrat Dan Feltes. Laura Kanoy and NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers will moderate. Again, that's Tuesday morning, live at 9 on NHPR. And here are some of the headlines that NHPR has been following this week. Schools in New Hampshire are getting an additional $45 million to help with coronavirus-related expenses. Governor Chris Sununu announced the funding at a press conference yesterday following recommendations from lawmakers. Most of the money, which comes to the state from the Federal CARES Act, will go to school districts directly. $10 million will go into an emergency reserve fund for districts unable to cover coronavirus-related expenses, even with the additional aid. Also, the family of Maura Murray, a 21-year-old nursing student who disappeared after a February 2004 car crash in New Hampshire, is asking for a state highway historical marker to be installed at the spot where she vanished. For years, the family kept a blue ribbon tied around a tree near the road in Haverhill, but the Caledonian Record reports the property owner wants to cut down that tree. And the family and others were planning to submit their application today to the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources in Concord. They say their petition has more than 3,000 signatures. And indoor hockey rinks in New Hampshire are shutting down for 2 weeks after a spate of COVID-19 outbreaks. During the past 2 months, at least 158 youth and adult players have contracted the virus. That includes players from 23 different teams. The shutdown on indoor hockey applies to collegiate as well as amateur teams. Health officials say they will release new guidelines before the rinks are allowed to reopen. And that's it for today, but you can find a link to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. And just a reminder, since voting is on top of mind for so many people, we are doing a show on the voting process Monday at 9 a.m., and we want to get your questions answered. So send them by email now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And you can also check out our voting guide, which is at nhpr.org. Exchange Fellow Jane Vaughn produced the show. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Christina Phillips answered the phones today, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.